So this morning, towards the end of the class, I was discussing the four verses of the 12th chapter of Gita, from 8th to 11th verse, which gives the four stages of human evolution in devotional life. First, on the, in the 8th verse, Lord Krishna says that a devotee of the highest type lives in God and God lives in him. He makes only one statement, nivasishasi mayeva. That's the only statement. You will live in me, or you would live in me. That's the idea behind. If you dedicate your mind and intellect to me, then you would live in me. But commentators and interpreters give a clearer interpretation, and they say that it means that God takes his residence in the devotee's heart, and the devotee also lives in an atmosphere of constant remembrance of God. Now, this is the devotee of the highest type. But you can't say that is the easy way, because such devotees are very rare. Maybe great devotees like Prahlada. Now he gives another option to those who have not reached this level of devotional development. They can reach this level by constant practice of certain disciplines in devotional life. And it is, technically, it is called in devotional literature, it is called Abhyasa Yoga. Abhyasa means repetition, exercise. Constantly remembering God, thinking about his glories, and somehow associating all our activities, mental, physical, intellectual activities, with God, create a link between our day-to-day existence and God. Some time back when I was explaining this idea, somebody raised this question. In fact, why should we take to the path of devotion? Meditation is enough. You may remember what Yatishiranandaji was saying in his book this morning. I read that portion, you know. Meditation is an advanced form of devotional exercise. When we normally say we are meditating, we are actually only thinking. Meditation in Sanskrit term is dhyanam. It is a higher level of spiritual exercise. When we are able to dwell completely on a single idea, when we are able to focus our whole mind on one idea to such an extent that we forget our own existence for a short time, 12 seconds or something, it is called meditation. But when we normally practice meditation, and I am taking meditation class here every Tuesday, but I can explain this idea to them only at a later stage, not at this stage. Right now we are only thinking of God. We are trying to focus our mental energies, mental vibrations, mental impulses towards God. And this meditation becomes really possible only when we are fully established in external and internal disciplines, which are explained in the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, Yama and Niyama. I won't go into those details right now. Through a constant practice of inner and outer discipline, external and internal discipline, when a mind is prepared, when it is ready to completely focus on the thought of God, then only meditation becomes a reality. Till then, it is only contemplation. But this contemplation can be intensified, it can be enriched, it can be reinforced by connecting by establishing a link which connects our meditative process with the rest of our day-to-day activities. See, when we work, when we study, when we perform other duties and responsibilities, if we can somehow think of God, then we are establishing a connecting link between our day-to-day activities and meditation or spiritual practice, which we normally perform only twice or three times a day, a morning, evening, and sometimes midnight or some other times. So, in this process, in this way, we make our total life more and more spiritual. And at a higher level, meditation becomes a reality. Till then, it is only an attempt to concentrate our mind on God. This is the fact. So, Sri Krishna, the teacher of Bhagavad Gita, gives an option to those who cannot fully dedicate their mind and intellect to God. And this is possible, according to him, through Abhyasa Yoga. So in the ninth verse he says, Atha chittam samadhadum na shaknoshi mayi sthiram Abhyasa yogena tadu ma michhaptum dhananjaya. The meaning is this. If you cannot fully and completely devote your mind and intellect to God, then try to get yourself mentally and physically involved in some kind of devotional exercises. So we hear many things, let instead of hearing undesirable or spiritually harmful things, let us hear things which are spiritually helpful. Again, we may recite many things instead of reciting spiritually harmful things or unhelpful things. Let us recite songs or hymns or devotional songs, whatever may be, which are helpful in spiritual life. So, Sravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasim, Sakhim, Atma, Nivedanam. This is technically called Navadha Bhakti. I won't go into those details right now in this context. Navadha Bhakti, for your information, for those who are more interested, you find this Navadha Bhakti mentioned in Adhyatma Ramayana and also in Bhagavata Purana. Two types, they belong to two different categories. What I recited now is from Bhagavata. The idea is simple. Hearing, seeing, talking, thinking, speculating, everything. Somehow establish a connecting link between all these mental and spiritual and physical activities with the idea of God. This is the second option given to spiritual aspirants by Krishna, which anyone can do, which anyone can practice. But then Lord Krishna comes down still to a lower level of devotees. There are many people who cannot mentally and physically and intellectually think or contemplate about God. Such people, there are people who cannot do that. They may engage in different activities and they will not be able to think of God or hear about God during these activities. For such people, Sri Krishna gives a third option. Abhyasepi asamarthosi mattharma paramo bhava madartham api karmani kurvan siddhim avapsisi. Even if you cannot practice Abhyasa Yoga, do everything, whatever work you do. But think, madartham means, think that you are doing everything for my sake. You know, if you can always remember that whatever you are doing is not for your sake, but for the sake of God, then every action indirectly brings in the memory of God, the thought of God. So that will slowly spiritualize all our activities. And it becomes Abhyasa Yoga. And when it becomes Abhyasa Yoga, when you become fully established in this, then actually at a higher stage, you will start living in God. And God will also start living in you. So whatever you do, you think that you are doing all this to all this in the name of God. Whatever you do is God's work, not your work. Now again Lord Krishna comes down, the teacher of Gita comes down to the devotee of the lowest type. He says, even if you can't think that whatever you do is a work for God, all right, you do, but then keep in mind that the results are not yours. Whatever you do, mentally, you surrender your actions and also the results to God. This is very easy. In fact, that was the method which Sri Ramakrishna prescribed to Girichandra Ghosh. Girichandra Ghosh is a famous character in Sri Ramakrishna's life. A bohemian who led a wayward life, but he was a gifted man, a dramatist, a playwright. And most of the time he was drunk. He was an alcoholic. Now, but he had one good quality which Sri Ramakrishna makes use of to uplift him to a higher level of spiritual consciousness. He was a truthful person. When Sri Ramakrishna asked him, why don't you take God's name the morning after waking on, when you wake up? He said, I don't know when I'm going to wake up. Because, you know, a great Jivan Mukta, a highly liberated soul, and also drunkard, both of them will be living in eternity. They are transcend time, space and causation, you know. A liberated soul becomes identified with the eternal, the infinite reality, which is beyond time, space and causation. And also drunkard may not know when he's going to sleep, and he won't know when he's going to wake up. So this man said, well, I can't be sure when I'm going to wake up, when I'm going to sleep. So he cannot give word that he would take the name of God in the morning and the evening. Then ultimately Sri Ramakrishna told him, you give your responsibility, your spiritual responsibility, you hand over that to me and I shall look after that. So he thought it's somewhat very easy. He doesn't have to do anything. The whole responsibility is taken over by Sri Ramakrishna. But from that moment onwards, it became physically and mentally impossible for him to do anything wrong. Because the feeling that he has handed over his spiritual responsibility to his great guru made it impossible for him to do anything wrong. And he became a saint. That's the story of Girichandra Ghosh. So, this is the fourth option which Lord Krishna gives. That's the 11th verse of the 12th chapter. So he says, Atha etadabhi ashaktosi kartum madhyoga masridaha sarva karma phalatyaga tadakkuryatatmava. So, if you can't think, when you are active, if you can't think that you are doing my work, all right, you do, but mentally you give up all the results of your activities to me. That's enough. These are the four options which Lord Krishna gives in the Gita. So from an ordinary spiritual aspirant's point of view, you have to begin with the 11th verse, then you have to go to the 10th, then 9th, and the 8th verse describes the position, the status, the devotion status of a devotee of the highest type. This is with regard to Bhagavad Gita. Now, sometimes, you know, a very big question that is often raised by devotees in spiritual life is this. See, what happens to those who practice for some time and then fail to continue their practice? And Vedantic tradition is very generous. It makes a very important point clear that whatever little you practice, it becomes an asset. It is something like a deposit that you have put in the bank. You can draw your check later on, if not in this life, in the next life. Now, in this connection, in the sixth chapter, you find a few verses in which Arjuna puts a question to Sri Krishna. What happens to those who practice meditation or devotion or spiritual sadhana, spiritual practice for some time, for some years, and then fail, then somehow they may fall by the wayside, they may fail to make any progress. Some of them may have a fall, some of them may die without or before reaching their goal, spiritual goal. What happens to them? In this connection, for those who are not familiar with, a few points should be kept in mind. Vedantic religion believes not in one life. It believes in cyclicism at the micro level and also the macro level. At the micro level, an individual takes birth, is born, he is a baby, then child, then a boy, young man, middle-aged, and then he becomes an old man, he dies and he is reborn. In the Gita itself, we find in the beginning, Dekhinasmin yatha dekhi kaumaram yavvanam jara tatha dekhantara praptihi dhiras tatrana mukhyati. Lord Krishna makes a very interesting statement. That's a very crucial point in Vedantic philosophy for any student of Indian spiritual heritage, Vedantic spiritual heritage. The sloka means this. This body is born. It grows. It evolves. Then it perishes. But there is something which is imperishable. This Atman. This Atman, which is called Jivatman or individual soul as you like. It never perishes. It continues to exist. So all the changes mean birth, existence, growth, evolution, decay and death. These are called the six changes which every empirical phenomenon has to undergo. Now, jayade, asti, vardhade, viparinamade, kshiyade, nasyade. In fact, Yaska, the great lexicographer of Veda, is called Yasa Nirukta, almost 3rd-4th century BC, he makes this point very clear in his Nirukta. He says, everything in this world, anything is phenomenal or empirical thing, it has to undergo these six changes. It takes birth. In fact, it's a change because it did not exist. From a state of non-existence, it comes into existence. Apparently. Not that it did not exist earlier. I mean, that's what we call birth. Appearance in visible form is birth. And then it exists. Then it evolves from babyhood to boyhood, then to youth and so on. And then it evolves and it decays and dies out. Which means, when birth means coming into existence within the time frame. And death means vanishing from time frame. That's what is called death and birth and death. So everything in this world which is empirical, which is phenomenal, it comes into existence sometime in the past, exists for some time, and vanishes sometime in future. This is true of Vedanta. This is true of all Indian philosophical systems. Except, of course, Jaina philosophy, of course. And Charvakas. Now, Sri Krishna says, this individual soul uses this physical body as a vehicle. Physical body perishes. individual soul is reborn in another body. Now, that means again rebirth. Again the game of human life continues. So, it is a kind of cycle or circle. Now, we don't know where a cycle begins. We don't know where it ends. So, it is infinite. The samsara or worldly existence is supposed to be a kind of cycle. That's true of cosmic existence also. Entered cosmic existence. Things come into existence from the subtle and it exists in the form of gross, goes back to the subtle, again the cycle begins. Sarga and Kalpa, these two concepts are interrelated to this. Now the idea is this, whatever you do in this life, even a little bit of spiritual practice, even if you meditate for an hour in your 100, you may live for 100 years, you meditate only for 1 hour. Or you may live 100 years, you attend a retreat or Upanishad Gita class only once. That won't be lost. It will be kept in your account, in the bank. And in your next life, when you are born, if you happen to have any association with any scripture, if you happen to see a book on Gita in the library for the first time, if you read it, this association, these impressions that you have accumulated, maybe 10 or 15 births earlier, maybe in the 7th or 8th century AD, it may come to the surface and it will connect. So, if you read again those verses, your spiritual, accumulated spiritual culture will be enriched. And it goes on enriching. That means nothing will be lost. This is the point which Sri Krishna makes clear. So, in the 37th verse of 6th chapter, those of you have got the book can see, Arjuna puts a question to Krishna. Ayadi sraddhayo pedu yoga chalida manasaha aprapa yoga samsiddhim kam gadim Krishna gachati. Anybody, any spiritual aspirant could ask this question these days. What happens to those who have not realized the Supreme God? Who have not made any real progress in spiritual life, what happens if he has a deviation from spiritual life, or if he happens to die before he reaches his goal? What will be his gati? Gati means what will be his fate? Arjuna puts a very straightforward question to Krishna. And then Arjuna further, he explains his point. Kachinu ubhaya vibhrashtaka chinna bhramiva nasyadi apradishtho mahabahu vimudho brahmanapati. I shall explain this. Unless you quote these verses, you won't feel that is something really serious. So, Arjuna again reinforces his point. He says, ubhaya vibhrashta means neither this life nor next life. Means, suppose a man gives up his terrible obsession, attachment to worldly pleasures, and diverts a lot of his time and energy in spiritual practices. Maybe he has to face a lot of opposition from his relatives, friends, and so on. And then, he spends a lot of time and energy in spiritual practices. Suppose he has a deviation before he reaches his goal or he happens to die. Then, don't you think it is a kind of ubhaya vibhrashtatva, means having lost this world, that means empirical prosperity and prospects, and also spiritual growth. You have lost both. Don't you think this is what is going to happen to somebody who happens to deviate, who happens to face a deviation from his spiritual path? And he will be lost like a flying piece of cloud. No cloud, thin clouds floating in the sky according to the movement of wind. That's how Arjuna compares the fate. I mean, according to him, the fate of somebody who tries to lead a spiritual life, but fails and dies out. Now, then he says, Edanme samsayam krishna chetu markasi asheshataka. Tudanne samsayasya chetanan hivapattite. He says, nobody can clear my doubt. You are the only one who can clear this doubt. In answer to this problem, Sri Krishna presents one of the most unique, one of the most promising, encouraging messages of Vedanta philosophy. So how different Vedanta philosophy, Vedantic approach is from the views of other monotheistic religions, you can just imagine. Only one life. If ever difficulty gone once for all, you become eternal residents in hell. Hellfire and brimstone for the rest of your life. Come damned once for all. This is true of most of the monotheistic religious concepts and also according to Madhva philosophy. Madhva also believes there is a class of people who are eternal residents in hell. Even if they pray, no, they are doomed once for all. Now, Vedantic approach is entirely different. Krishna says, Partha naiveha namutra vinashas tasya vidyate. Nahi kalyanakrit kashit durgadin tata gacchati. This is the answer. This is how Sri Krishna begins his answer. Very celebrated passage in the Gita. From 37th to 43rd verse, you can find Arjuna's question and Krishna's answer. So he says, Partha naiveha namutra. He won't be lost either here or hereafter. Anyone who practices even a little bit of spiritual practice, it will remain as a permanent deposit in his name. He says, if he dies or if he fails in achieving his goal, he doesn't have to worry. Because even a little bit of, even the slightest spiritual practice will become a saving factor. So, Tvam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. Somewhere else, even Krishna says, but I'm not coming to those points because of want of time. So, what Sri Krishna says, Nahi kalyanakrit kaschit durgadim tadagacchati. Anyone who does something noble, something to elevate his spiritual life, either reading the sacred scriptures a few times in his life, praying to God with sincerity once, or meditating or dwelling on noble thoughts at least once in his life, that man, I have guaranteed, I have promised, he will not be lost. That is Sri Krishna's answer. That's why sometimes you may have seen when you go to a library, you may not have practiced anything in your spiritual life. You may not have prayed once even. You may not have read anything. But suppose you go through a bookstall or library or a bookshop. Suddenly you come across a book which you just turn a few pages. Suddenly you find there is something interesting, something which you perhaps were not aware of earlier. Oh, this is a wonderful book. You buy this book. Or you take the book from the library. It sometimes brings about a change in your life. Or a friend of yours tells you, well, there is an institution where there are spiritual lectures going on, some activities related to spiritual life. Come on, why don't you visit that place? And if you happen to go there, suddenly you find, oh, this is something interesting. If you have not had any contact with that spiritual culture, you won't be able to appreciate it. You won't be able to withstand it. It's not possible. Anyone who has not had any spiritual contact or spiritual life sometime, somewhere in the past, maybe several centuries, somewhere you might have been born in some other culture, some other countries, wherever it is. Unless you have had accumulated some spiritual impression and it remains in potential form somewhere in the corner of your heart, you won't be able to appreciate these things. That is how the accumulated spiritual impressions start working out in one's spiritual life. So Sri Krishna says, he won't be lost, he will continue experiencing this. And then Sri Krishna continues, Purvabhyasena tenaiva kriyadehi avashopi saha. Says, suppose Purvabhyasa means something you have done in the past. If you have done something great in the past, if you have done something wonderful in the past, that will come to full form. So, Parthana Ivehanamutra Vinashastasya Vidyade Nahi Kalyanakrit Kasi Durgadin Tada Gachadi. Then Krishna says, Prapya Punyakritam Logan Ushitva Shashuti Samaha Shuchinam Simatam Gehe Yoga Bhrashto Bhijayate Athava Yoginam Eva Kule Bhavati Dhimatam Edatki Durlabhadaram Loki Janmayadidrisham Tatratam Buddhi Samyogam and so on. The Krishna continues. Now, what happens to those who do some spiritual practice and they die out before they reach their goal? They will be born in a family where they will be able to continue the spiritual life. Because parents who have done some spiritual sadhana in their life will have children who deserve to be born as their parents. So it is a kind of concordance, in fact. Parents who have done spiritual practices in their life will naturally be blessed with children who have an innate spiritual tendency. And these individual souls who have done some spiritual sadhanas, practices in their life, you will be blessed to be born in families, to parents, and in environments where they can continue their spiritual life further beyond. Two types of rebirth are mentioned for those devotees in the Gita. Those who practice spirituality in their life, and then they fail to reach the supreme goal because of some desire, some bondage, some unfulfilled desire, which made them deviate from the spiritual path. They will be born in a set of circumstances where they will have enough scope to fulfill their unfulfilled desires so that they can evolve further, go beyond that level. And those who have practiced complete detachment and renunciation, dedicated devotion to God, who have absolutely no desire at all, but they die before they reach their goal. What happens? They will be born in a family of yogis. They may not be prosperous, but they will be grey, they will be men of renunciation, men or women of renunciation. Athava yogina meva kule bhavati dhimatam. These higher types of people, souls, they will be born in families where they will have a strong spiritual atmosphere, where they can go further beyond in their spiritual life. But those who have some unfulfilled desire to be fulfilled, they will be born in families where they will need something because some desires still remain unfulfilled. So they will be born in a family where they can continue their enjoyment to some extent, and once that enjoyment is over, they also will start practicing their spiritual life. Because purvabhyasena tenaiva means kriyadehi avashopi saha, means you are helpless because you have done something in your spiritual life. So you cannot help coming and putting your name for the retreat. Otherwise, it is not a very pleasant, you are not going to gain anything. Unless one has accumulated some spiritual culture in the previous life, one will not be able to continue in spiritual life. Gita, in this context, Lord Krishna is very, very, very graphic, he says. So he says, avashyaka means such a spiritual practitioner, such an aspirant will be helpless because he is propelled and compelled by his previous samskaras and impressions to go beyond the present level and practice more and more spiritual sadhanas. This is what happens. And then what happens? It stays. Tatratam buddhi samyogam labhade paurvadekhikam yatadecha tato bhoya samsiddho kurunantana. Then what happens? Such a devotee? A devotee who practiced some spiritual sadhanas, spiritual practices, and then pass away, die before they reach their goal. What happens? When he is reborn, paurvadehika means the culture, the spiritual culture that this devotee has accumulated in previous life with the previous body. He may have done a lot of meditation, prayer and so on. That buddhi means that spiritual culture suddenly starts sprouting. So, tatratam buddhi samyogam labhade paurodekikam. He gets back the deposit he has made in previous life. The good result of the good deeds, spiritual practices he has done in previous life suddenly starts manifesting in his life. And then what happens? He continues his journey. It won't be lost. That's a great and a unique feature of Vedantic tradition. You are never late and nothing will be lost. You can start a new life any moment you like. Such examples are numerous in Vedantic tradition. You may know perhaps the oldest and possibly the first Sanskrit classical work is Ramayana. Some of you must have read it, most of you perhaps at least. Now, who wrote this Ramayana? Actually, a robber wrote this Ramayana. A robber who earned his livelihood mostly by murdering and robbing innocent people, wayfarers, pilgrims. That was his main job. So, one day, as he went about his night shift, perhaps, he comes across a group of sages who were perhaps moving towards a pilgrim center. Narada was also one of them, perhaps. And what happened? So this robber tried to rob them, maybe tried to murder them. Then they asked this question, all right, you don't have to work very hard. We shall give you whatever you want. Whatever we have got, we shall give you. But one question, for whose sake are you doing all this? You are doing something very wicked. You are killing, you are robbing, you are hurt, injuring, doing harm to innocent people, pilgrims and wayfarers. What are you going to gain from this? You are incurring a terrible sin by doing all these evil deeds. Could you tell us, for whose sake are you doing all this? The robber said that he has his wife and children and so on. In fact, he was doing all this just to look after them. That was his profession. Then they reminded him, look here, that's perfectly all right. But, you know, what you are doing right now is something absolutely evil. And you have to pay a terrible price for this. And you have to suffer so much in your next life. Could you go and ask your wife and children whether they will be able to share the results of your actions? They are sharing whatever you take away from innocent people. But will they share the consequences? This man, well, he thought for a moment and they told, look here, you need not worry, we'll remain here. You come back and we'll give whatever we have got, we'll give you. Go and ask there. Wife and children. He went and asked. They said, no. You are doing all this, your duty to look after us. By robbing or murdering, we don't know. You are bringing money, it's your duty. That fellow was terribly shocked. He thought, he didn't know about this. And then he became a new man. He was completely transformed. He asked them to give him some spiritual instruction. And it is said that his name was Ratnakara. Ratnakar, that was his name. And remember, and that Ratnakar became the great Valmiki, one of the greatest saints of Indian tradition. And he was the author of the first important classical work of Sanskrit tradition, Sanskrit language, Adi Kavya, which is called Valmiki Ramayana, which extols, describes the story of Rama. In fact, the central theme is dharma itself. Dharma means righteousness, how to lead a proper life. And Rama was the embodiment of all the noble virtues. So Valmiki wrote this. So he became as immortal as Rama himself. Now, that was before his transformation. Then these sages instructed him, initiated him into a sacred mantra and asked him to sit and recite this mantra. And he continued his, and he closed his eyes, and he was a robber, mind you. So he was a man of action. So once he became a new man, he was completely transformed. And after a long time, they came back through the same route. They found a huge anthill. So they knew it should be this robber. Having opened eyes, man has become a saint. That is how Valmiki was born. Ratnakar died and Valmiki was born. So what really happened? An earlier story, that this Ratnakar's previous life, he was himself a saintly man. Somehow he happened, he had done a lot of spiritual practices, but he somehow, by error, by mistake, he happened to do some evil deeds, as a result of which he was born as a robber. But whatever he had done, whatever spiritual practices he had performed in previous life, were not lost. So as a result of those good deeds, he happened to meet the sages. They gave him a new direction and he became a saint. So, it is true of many great spiritual personalities you find. So, when the sages asked him, are you going to pay for the consequences or your wife and children? This man thought for some time. He could think for some time because he had some spiritual impressions he had accumulated in previous life. Otherwise, nobody robbers want spare time to contemplate on these things. You know, they will go about a job. But Ratnakar was a saint in his previous life. So that made him think. And that thought ultimately became the cause of his transformation. That's why the 43rd verse says, Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade paurvadekikam. So whatever little spiritual practices you have done in this life, with this present body, will remain intact and sometime in future, it will start working out under appropriate circumstances, favorable circumstances. And then what happens? Then Lord Krishna says, Purvabhyasena tenaiva kriyate ki avashopi saha. Jijnyasir abhiyogasya sabde brahma adivartate. Then Lord Krishna says, by the power of the influence, the impulses, the spiritual impressions that this devotee has accumulated in his previous life, he becomes helpless. He can't but become a new man. He cannot but continue his spiritual practices. Because there are certain things that you do in your life, you try your best, you cannot do it otherwise. That is what is called Purvabhyasa, means sometimes called anusudha sabhava. I mean, certain characteristics, certain way of behaving and doing things, which you cannot change however you may try. Certain inherent characteristics. That's why Swami Vivekananda in one of his lectures says, one is good because he can't help being good, and one is bad because he can't help being bad. Means the pull or the momentum of impressions and impulses that you have accumulated in previous life may work in your favor if the devotee had practiced a little bit of spiritual practice. That's what Lord Krishna says. I think, yes, up to, yeah, 5 or 2. Now, this can be further demonstrated, made clear in the light of several examples. Most of you may be familiar with the chronicler of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Yam. Yam was a highly educated man, but he was suffering from a lot of family conflicts and disturbances. And one day at night, he almost decided to put an end to his life. So he starts at about 10:30 at night, he starts from his home. He goes about here and there, wanders about, and ultimately he happens to land in the home, happened to reach the home of his nephew. And he was a completely crippled, frustrated man. He was a well-educated man leading a very good life, was the headmaster of his school. But due to family squabbles and problems, he didn't have peace of mind. And next day, with the help of his nephew, Siddheshwara Majumdar, Yam happened to go to the Akshineswar temple, and there he happened to meet Sri Ramakrishna. And that was the beginning of a new life. So when he met Sri Ramakrishna, suddenly it flashed in his mind, who is this serene-looking, saintly man? He looks like Shuka. Shuka is the great teacher of Bhagavata Purana, or Chaitanya. These thoughts flashed through his mind. Who is this holy man talking to his devotees, sitting around him, about spiritual ideas? Yam was astounded. And then, that was the beginning of a new life. And Yam visited Sri Ramakrishna again, and he continued his visit, and he was the one who wrote all the instructions which Sri Ramakrishna was giving to his disciples in the form of a diary. And later it became the immortal spiritual classic that's known to the world as the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So many examples you can find in spiritual life. Because of the accumulated spiritual impressions, by the pull of that, that's why purvabhyasena tenaiva hi avasya, avasya means helpless. Once he met Sri Ramakrishna, he himself says, well, I feel like being drawn to him again and again. And he continued his visit, and he became the great Mahendranath Gupta, the world knows as the author of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. There are many such stories in the spiritual classics. Another story is in Bhagavata Purana. The story, you know, this story of a king. His name was Indradyumna. He was a great devotee of God. Mostly spent his time in worship, meditation, contemplation, scriptural reading, holy company, and so on. One day it so happened that he was immersed in meditation, and some great saints happened to visit his place. Called Agastya, it is. Great saint. And he was immersed in meditation, so he didn't care for the great saint who had come there. So then Agastya felt, well, he is a devotee, but there is something lacking in him. He behaves as a lifeless being. So he cursed him. Cursed means, you know, in the mythical literature, the curse has got a different meaning. A great saint tries to correct a spiritualized parent. The corrective process is sometimes like this. That's how Vyasa himself interprets. Vyasa, who is the author of this Puranic literature, says, all these stories have a story behind, a message behind. You should not take them literally. It is to drive home a sublime spiritual point that these stories are narrated. So Agastya felt this man is not doing his duty properly. Yeah, some guests have come and you are sitting there in meditation and puja and all that. So something wrong with him, he should be corrected. So he cursed him, you be born as an elephant. That's just how the story goes. To drive home one point. So he was born as an elephant. And you know, for a long time this elephant is a mighty bull elephant. It moved with female elephants, it had a very happy life with the forest regions. And one day it so happened that he entered a lake just to drink water. And it was caught by a crocodile, a powerful crocodile. And this elephant and this crocodile began to pull each other down. The elephant tried to drag the crocodile out of water so that he can crush it. And the crocodile tried to drag the elephant towards the lake, so there the elephant would be drowned. He can be drowned. Anyhow, the Puranic story, you know, it's just a mythological story, but the story has got a great spiritual message behind it. This war between the crocodile and elephant continued for a long time. And ultimately, suddenly, this elephant suddenly remembered his previous life. In his previous life, he was a king. His name was Indradyumna. That's the story goes. It's called Gajendra Moksham story you find in Bhagavata Purana. So, suddenly he remembered when he felt that he was almost on the verge of being dragged to the lake, into the lake and be drowned. Death was staring at him. At that moment, when he felt absolutely helpless, he suddenly remembered he was the great king, the devotee who was meditating, and because of his inertia or laziness, he got his curse. This idea suddenly flashed in his mind. And when this idea flashed in his mind, he took a lotus flower which was floating near the lake, you know, and mentally meditating on Lord Vishnu, God, he just threw it. And Vishnu came and saved him from the clutches of the crocodile. That's how the story goes. The crocodile had a different story. He was also Gandharva. I don't want to go into details of the Puranic story. I want you to focus on the Gajendra, I mean the elephant part of the story, because that's what is prominent here. Why? Because this elephant suddenly remembered in a crisis when he felt absolutely helpless. He suddenly remembered. So, before that, this mighty bull elephant was roaming through the forests, full of pride, proud of his strength, and he was a hero of the elephant community, mind you. At that time, he didn't think about God. But when he felt that he was on the verge of being dragged into the lake and be drowned by the crocodile, when he felt that death was staring at him on the face, at that moment, he suddenly remembered. And that memory was so strong because he was such a great spiritual practitioner, sadhaka, bhakta, devotee, that the sudden flashing memory was enough to transform this elephant. Immediately he took a lotus and he, with his prayer, he threw into the lake. Means, and it reached the feet of God. That's what the Purana story says. And God appeared for him. So that's how it happened. That Purvabhyasena Tenaiva Hi Avasya means, this Purvabhyasa, days accumulated treasure of or treasury of memories and impressions can be liability also, it can be a great blessing also. That is why one should always try to practice spirituality, should practice devotion one way or other. If you can't go to a place of worship, you take a holy scripture and read it. If still that book is not available, you think of these holy thoughts. Think these holy thoughts. So somehow, the mind should be filled with positive impressions, which are helpful in spiritual life. Otherwise, negative memories and negative impressions will be accumulated in mind, and they also will drag you in the opposite direction. There are certain people, you know, see, it is said in criminology, there are certain criminals, see, they are put in prison, they feel so restless. Unless they commit some crime, they don't feel all right. So they don't feel all right. So they have to do some mischief, otherwise they feel restless, you know. So purabhyasa means the accumulated memories and impressions can have a negative implication also. So that's why every devotee should always try to accumulate spiritually useful, positive tendencies, attitudes and impressions and impulses, and try to fill their minds with these positive attitudes, impressions and samskaras, so that they constitute the fuel which take you further beyond. As a rocket needs fuel to every vehicle needs a fuel. So positive spiritual impulses and tendencies constitute the fuel which propel you in your spiritual path. That's what Lord Krishna means here. Because it will not be lost. When you find yourself under favorable circumstances, these positive spiritual impressions will suddenly come to the surface. And if the condition is favorable, they get further enriched, further strengthened. That will take you further, further and further in spiritual life. This is what Lord Krishna means. So this morning we didn't have enough time for interaction. If you got doubts or any points for clarification, you can ask. Otherwise, I shall continue the same topic for some time more. You can just, if there is anything you want to ask, you can ask. Just. Oh, Dhruva. Uh-huh.
And therefore, the discussion now, there is validity in karma, theory of karma. Mm. The past tendencies, that is, see, savings account, so to say, all things. And the bad things, the criminal ideas, and dragging oneself down. Mm. So there is validity in this. Therefore, it is good to have the thoughts, okay, if I do something like this, my journey towards the salvation.
One point, it need not necessarily be an action, physical action. Even a flash of thought, yes. Thought current, a tendency which may not necessarily take the form of external activity, can also have its, can register its impression on the mind. It's called chittam, you know. It can register. It will sprout. In fact, the power of these impressions is in direct proportion to the power with which the memory registered in the mind. And this impression again depends upon with what amount of intensity you experience that event. I shall give an example. Please, you can continue. I am not blocking on the way. But one point I have to make me clear. See, suppose you are traveling by the road. You may see so many pebbles, stones, and so many things. You may see those things with your eyes, but your mind won't dwell on them. But suppose you are chased by a dog, God forsake, God blessing, it never happens. But suppose something like that happens, so you are chased by a snake, then that memory will register very powerfully in your mind. And suppose being chased by a dog, you would run and you break your leg. Please, God forbid that such things ever happened. I am giving an example. Suppose such a thing happens, then that memory will be very powerful. So any event, any action, any activity in which we are directly involved, where mind, intellect, all are involved, they create a powerful impression in the mind. So if you have done spiritual practice with great intensity and sadhā, it will leave a strong impression. If it is just a mechanical kind of worship, it may not register very powerfully. So the intensity of these impressions is in direct proportion to the intensity with which you have yourself involved in that activity. That makes a lot of difference. Now please continue.
So there is a prayaschitta. Yes, he remembers it is something wrong, and so he does something good to, and then he says, "I have to be more refined. I have to keep purity in my mind," and then he will be watchful of what he does. So that is positive. Am I right, Maharaj?
Yes.
This theory of karma has also some beneficial.
Yes.
So may not believe in this, but at least. As a kind of humility, and then...
The theory of karma is very flexible. The karma is not an almighty tyrant in whose hands you are a helpless puppet. No. If your today is the result of your actions yesterday, then your tomorrow will be the result of your actions today. So you have got a lot of scope to improve your lot. So theory of karma leaves a lot of margin and freedom for you to evolve further and, in a way, build up your own future. That's very important.
And then, Maharaj, Grecian divorce. So, you gave the example.
Yes.
So, he gives a power of attorney to Sri Ramakrishna. So, he gets out of it. He says, okay, I'll take responsibility. Therefore, if a bhakta, the devotee, if he says, keeping all this in mind, I start my work thinking of you. Along the way, I got to meet all these, you know, different characters, and then I have to fight all these things. And then you do it, and then offer to Sri Ramakrishna. Then he is absorbed, isn't
it? Yes. So that's what it implies. Yes, because if a spiritual seeker sincerely surrenders himself to God, if that surrender is sincere. Then he can't consciously do anything wrong. In fact, that is the psychology behind the concept of confession. If you confess sincerely, you can't do anything wrong consciously again. So it will have a corrective effect on the rest of your life. So Girishandra Ghosh was such a sincere man. He openly said, well, I can't give word that I will take the name of God. And a lesser man, may not be very sincere. He would say, all right, tomorrow onwards I will. And he won't follow that instruction. It won't have any effect either on Girishandra Ghosh or on Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna won't be able to save him. Because sincerity is necessary, you know. But Sri Ramakrishna says, vyakulata, sincerity, integrity. Sri Ramakrishna stresses this point, vyakulata. Vyakulata implies all this, sincerity, earnestness, integrity, truthfulness. All these are implied in that word. The Sanskrit word used in devotional literature has got a lot of psychological and metaphysical implications. Girishandra Ghosh was such a man of integrity, and Sri Ramakrishna understood that. That was why he asked him to give. Sri Ramakrishna doesn't ask everyone to give power of attorney. Sri Ramakrishna understood this man, he was leading a licentious life. Mostly, he'd be drunk, you know. And he was a dramatist, he was an actor. You can imagine 19th century. So, he himself didn't have very high opinion about his previous life. He himself has said what, as much. But Sri Ramakrishna understood, he was a very sincere, honest, truthful man. He won't promise anything which he knew very well he won't be able to practice. So, that Sri Ramakrishna understood. So, I asked him to give it to the world. That's the idea. So it worked with him. So if a man is sincere in his prayer, then it works. Then it really works. In fact, that is the psychological implication of the very concept of confession in Christian theology, according to Augustine and all. Augustine's famous book is The Confessions and Sunday God. But often these ideas get different interpretations in course of time.
I really don't understand the meaning of death in this sense, because we often say that life is always continuous, death is momentary. So if that's the case, supposing if you take great souls like Sri Ramakrishna, we should be experiencing them at any point of time, because even though they are not in their physical form, we should be able to experience them.
Yes.
But we don't. But at least I don't. Or secondly, for example, another case, for example, we have seen deaths in families across.
Yes.
And I have never experienced in my life that any person whom I have, say seriously, very near and dear one who has died, I have never come across a situation that a person comes back to me, either in dreams or in some kind of form, to say that, yes, there is a continuity. So how do we take it? Or is it just by meditation only we can reach that? Or is there any other conscious way to know that there is life beyond death also?
Yes. In fact, this question can be answered from two angles. One point to remember is, when you say that we cannot verify these things, you mean to say that you cannot verify this the way we verify scientific discoveries, scientific conclusions. Now, one point is, modern science, especially scientists who have reached a very high level of their intellectual evolution, they do admit that science has not yet exhausted the whole gamut of human knowledge. That is very obvious. So science, there are still many things which science has yet to prove. That's one thing. Second point is, scientific discoveries and scientific experiments are made within the range of certain tools and instruments related to scientific theories and formulas, which they all are related to the empirical, the phenomenal world, empirical world. But these things are trans-empirical. So to experiment or to experience those things, we need certain tools which are not right now available to modern science. So, even from a scientific point of view, you cannot disbelieve in a God whom you don't see. See, if you tell me that you don't believe in a God whom you don't see, I understand. But by the same yardstick, I can say you cannot disbelieve in anything which you don't believe. So, we can neither believe nor disbelieve in something which we don't see. Any of you? Or Swami Vedanandaji is a professional scientist. What's your, Swamiji, can you give an opinion?
Yes.
Can we disbelieve something that's not obvious to us? Swamiji is a professional scientist, a physicist. So what is your opinion, Swamiji? No, this can be an interaction,
You cannot prove, atheism cannot be proved, just like if a proof is wanted of religion, you can ask, is there proof for atheism? You cannot say there is no God. If you make a statement that you can't prove that there is a God, the equal statement can be made as you cannot prove that there is no God.
Yes. So you cannot disbelieve in God, the same, just as we cannot believe in God, whom you don't see with our open eyes. We can't prove in scientific, say, in a laboratory. So that's one argument. So that leaves another problem. So how we can go beyond the level of the empirical tools that are available to modern science today? The only answer is that those who have turned their inquiry into another channel, you call it meditation, spiritual practices, etc., have experienced the presence and the existence of God. But that again they cannot prove with the tools available to modern science today, but they cannot disprove it. That's the idea behind. So the best way for you to do is, I generally know what happens. See, you turn to something transcendental. Sometimes, under certain circumstances, when you feel you need something, consolation, an answer to a crisis or a problem, when you find that, well, it is not available at the present empirical world, then you are forced to turn your inquiry in another direction, higher direction. Then you may accidentally knock at the door and it will be opened. That's what happens to many scientists and others. That's all we can say. Ultimately, belief in God cannot be thrust upon anybody. Just as disbelief in God cannot be thrust upon anybody. That's all.
What is the any science, physical science, biological science, whatever, that's the study of material, a material which is studyable by us, by our five senses. Beyond that, there is no other entity that no scientist has the right to say. It may be many scientists' personal opinion there is nothing called God, and then many big scientists were indeed God believers. So whatever is not within the purview of scientific study, they don't know. And any scientist like Neil Bohr didn't believe in God. That's okay, that's his personal opinion. Einstein was not an agnostic or atheist. The question is, it is beyond the purview of science. This needs some other kind of tool beyond the five senses to study God. Now, a man who never went to school but learned from his life, he demanded that Einstein's theory of relativity be explained to him in 2 days. What do you do? He has never gone to school. He has never learned enough math. You cannot explain Einstein's theory to him, however you try. So it's the same logic. A scientist has no business to talk about things beyond the material world. The spiritual way that they have not studied. Before understanding Einstein's theory of relativity, you need to go for schooling for 16 years, 18 years, and then you need to be extraordinarily intelligent to understand that. Similarly, the path of spirituality has nothing to do with that. This is some kind of skill. You call it science, call it art, which the scientist has not been trained to. He has not gone to the school and college to learn enough math to understand Einstein's theory. So how can you explain to him? Similarly, this scientist cannot, individually somebody may be there. As a scientist, he has not been trained to think about God. So he has no right to say. Whatever he says is opinion, okay? He cannot say, God does not exist, nothing called God exists. It's not his subject.
We have any number of scientists here. There could be many here also, but I'm failing. So, see, they can. Dr. Mehta is a world-renowned scientist in another line. Kumar Mehta, but you know. See? So many scientists. He is a medical scientist we have got right now. So, just discuss with them. The point is, I myself not a scientist. Science, little part of I studied.
My question was not with exactly. My only question is that how do we really feel? What is the step, or in what state of mind do we really realize that Sri Ramakrishna is around us, or Sri Ma is around us? How do we really feel that? Or what are the process that we should do? It's not
one way. Well, we can start with, you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna thoroughly, and then in most cases, those who have read sincerely, Sri Ramakrishna had given them some flashing insights. It is any sincere aspirant can do it. One way, just as you study science, you also study the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. May not, because whatever the old traditional Sanskrit scriptures have explained, Sri Ramakrishna has explained very simple language which anyone can understand in this world. So that's one way you can begin with. Well, if you don't have any more doubts, then I can just I did one more story, and that is again it's very important because for every devotee, this is a serious subject. You know, how far we can practice and to what extent. This again, there is an interesting story which more rational. That's again in the Bhagavata Purana you find there's a story of a great emperor. He later became Jadabharata. His name was Bharata. And in fact, India's Sanskrit name is Bharatavarsha. In fact, there are two views. He got that name from this king, from this emperor. Another view is there. So another emperor Bharata mentioned in the Abhijana Shakuntalam. That I am not going to. Anyhow, this Bharata, he was a great emperor, and when he became very old, he decided, this is enough. Now let me spend the rest of my lifetime in a secluded place, meditating and thinking of God. In ancient India, there was a tradition, you know, when your hair becomes gray, or when a grandson is born to you, you should not continue living in your home. You should retire to a forest or a hermitage or a lonely place and spend the rest of your lifetime in meditation and spiritual practices. Manusmriti has got a famous injunction. Grihasthasya yada pasyet vali paridam atmanah apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasyet. Not very important for you. Anyhow, this is the dictum, this is the injunction. So the Bharata decided, enough is enough. He had a powerful kingdom, very prosperous kingdom, a huge army, all comfort, children. Then he decided, he declared his son as the heir apparent and he went to a forest. And there he built a small hermitage and he stayed there. And one day it so happened that a female deer was being chased by a lion. And as the deer ran and tried to cross a stream, it gave birth to a small deer. And that small cub fell in the water and the mother deer passed away. This king, the emperor, he took pity and he jumped into the stream and saved the life of the little deer. And this small deer grew up in his hermitage. There is nobody else, only this king. Now, in course of time, what really happened? This emperor who has given up his kingdom, his own children, his empire, everything, he became so attached to the deer that he cannot think of God, he cannot meditate, he cannot do any spiritual practice because he was so. What will happen after my death, this small deer? The old man, you know, he was trying to meditate. He was always afraid. Suddenly one lion will come or tiger will come and chase this deer. And he will come out and he will drive these wild animals away. So most of the time, he had to spend his time in saving this deer. So this king who had given up everything to pass his days, last days in spiritual contemplation, started to worry about what will happen to this deer after his passing away. Now, what really happened? In course of time, when he passed away, his mind was not thinking about God, but thinking about the fate of this deer. And he was born as the deer. This is how the story goes. So in Gita, you know, it is very statement. See, when you die, when your mind is helpless, your mind is weak and senses are weak, your natural tendencies and impressions, I mean, whatever you have accumulated through your actions in your mind, these impressions and these tendencies will come to the surface. Even a well-trained diplomat cannot put up another face when he dies. His natural character will come to the surface. So all spiritual classics insist that one should always try to keep the mind full of spiritual ideas. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyande kalayavaram. Tam tame vaiti kaundeya sada tad bhava bhavitah. It's a famous sloka verse in the Gita, which means whatever you think of, whatever you think on, whatever your mind is focused on at the time of death, you'd be born as that. So when an individual dies, his natural characteristics, the totality of all his actions in his life, in the subtle form, will come to the surface. And that will be the focus of thought for his mind. So that's why scriptures insist that you must always try to keep yourself engaged in spiritual thought currents. So this king was such a great saint, was born as a deer. But though he was born as a deer, that deer remembered what he was in his previous life. What a terrible tragedy it was for him. The great emperor who had left his kingdom, his palace, his children, everything, and came to hermitage and spent 40 years there, and when he was 130 years, he passed away, couldn't move, he was worried about what will happen to the deer. He remembered. So it spent these days in an ashrama, in a hermitage, in the forests. It never moved away from the hermitage because it was afraid of the world. It was caught, it was trapped once in previous life, didn't want to be trapped again. So, and then it died after some years, you know, natural death. And that deer was born as the great saint known as Jadabharata. Just think of it. A great emperor who was a great bhakta, a great devotee who practiced devotion all his life, was born as a deer. The deer was born as the great Jadabharata. So ultimately, the center of consciousness of our thoughts and activities should be always somewhere near our spiritual ideal. It may be God, it may be Atman, it may be Brahman, depending upon your choices. So that is very important in spiritual life. That's again, I am driving home this point, purabhyasena tenaiva, means that whatever we do in the past, it will take the form of the present. But it doesn't mean that we should be slaves, or we should be helpless tools in the hands of a tyrant fate, tyrant in the form of karma. No, karma is not a tyrant. Karma is a very flexible concept. The idea is this: if our present is the result of our past, then our future will be the result of the present. So by accumulating good karmas, good impressions, good tendencies through our physical, intellectual and mental actions, we can always build up our own spiritual destiny. That's what this implies. The same is true of many characters in the Mahabharata, Kunti. There are many such characters out there. mother of all the five Pandavas, you know. She prays only, she says, God, give me more and more misery. That's what is happening. Because when I'm miserable, I think of you. I'm not very sure I will think of you if everything is all right with me. So Kunti always prayed to God to give her more and more misery. Because when she is helpless, she feels the intense need to pray to God. And if everything is all right in this world, she may perhaps even forget God. So this is what happens. Now, Gita doesn't say that you should suffer misery in order to get the grace of God. Doesn't mean that. The idea behind is this. That point, particular point is trust. Rather, Gita gives a very compact and integrated philosophy of life. You may live in this world, but you need not be worldly minded. Keeping our mind focused on God, if we work hard for acquiring whatever is necessary for material life, Gita doesn't discourage that. That's what Gita says. So Gita insists on a harmony of the best of spiritual tradition and the best of secular life. That idea you find in the Gita throughout. The concept of Rajarshi is a classic example. In the fourth chapter, Lord Krishna says, the yoga tradition can be related to Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga and also Raja Yoga. The yoga tradition, the Vedantic tradition, what Swami Vivekananda called in modern times, practical Vedanta. The yoga tradition was somehow lost. That is, a harmonious blending of efficiency, hard work, discipline, punctuality, and I would say science, technology and their fruits, and spiritual ideas. This is what actually Gita and our devotional literature proclaims before you. If you read some scriptures, you find so much of stress on renunciation. But that's meant only for those who are obsessed with worldly pleasure. So those who think that worldly pleasure is only means and ends of human life, they would say, well, it won't take you the ultimate peace of mind. Gita doesn't say that you should become miserable to be able to enjoy the grace of God. So there are many such verses, you know, that may sometimes, it just stresses one point. Again, our devotional literature makes another important point. Every unpleasant event can be taken as a tool, as an instrument to promote our spiritual destiny. Even a tragedy, even a setback, which normally may cripple a man's mind, may make him depressed, can be turned into a tool to promote our spiritual life. To encourage those people who disbelieve in God because they suffer a lot, to encourage this, there is a famous verse in which the Lord says, those whom I want to bless, I take away all his wealth. Yasya anugraham ichyami tasya vittam haramiham. Bandhavaisya yogena brisham bhavati dukkhidaha. Tena dukkhena samtaptu yadimamna parityaje tam pasadam karishyami yet devai labhi sudurlabham. I should translate in English. It is a famous verse which is a very sublime verse related to devotional tradition. The meaning is this. Those whom I want to bless, God says, I will take away from him all the material comforts which make him forget me. Because thereby God is promoting his spiritual destiny. Yasya anugraham ichyami tasya vittam haramiha means I will steal his wealth. That's literally what it means. Means God will take away all from you, all that stand in your spiritual progress. And if you're too much attached towards worldly pleasures, towards things and and material comforts which drown you in this misery of material world and which make you forget spiritual ideas. Then what happens? He will isolate you from your friends and from your near and dear ones. Still, if the devotee never forgets God, then I shall make him the recipient of my blessing, infinite blessings, which even gods cannot share. That is a literal translation. So such statements you find in devotional literature. It's only to encourage. Too much of pleasure sometimes makes you forget God. Too much of misery also makes you forget God. So a devotional literature is full of ideas which present an integrated philosophy of life, a complete and integrated philosophy of life. In a single, it can be put in a very simple statement given by Sri Ramakrishna. With one hand, you hold the feet of God. With the other hand, you work in this world. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. And if you do it sincerely, then God will enable you to hold his feet with both his hands. That is the Vedanta concept. That is the devotional literature. So I think we have already exhausted the time limits. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna.